What I'm going to talk to you about is a theme which I think is connected but to the theme of the conference. Just to let you know how this paper, this presentation arose, we were asked by the candidates in our society to have a day conference on pleasure, because the candidates quite rightly thought that pleasure does get little attention in psychoanalytical, contemporary psychoanalytical literature, which I think is true. So this is the result of the thoughts that followed that request from our candidates. This is going to be a mainly clinical presentation. I hope you're up for it, because clinical material can be sometimes a bit hard to follow. I'm sorry I can't sort of distribute copies of the paper. Just listen to it and see what you can absorb. So if you have problems, you know, you might not be able to sort of take everything in. So the subject of pleasure is vast and complicated, and I think it's an impossible task really to capture and distill the essence of the multitude of subjectively colored experiences which can be defined as pleasure. First, there is this difficulty, definition, what is pleasure? Then the dualism of pleasure and unpleasure, I think, soon appears. And more specifically, can one think of pleasure without thinking of unpleasure? And since I want to think about pleasure in analysis, can one talk about pleasure without thinking of psychic pain? Now, I just want to give you some very, very brief theoretical pointers about first Freud's views about pleasure and then some more contemporary, not so much contemporary views about pleasure, but psychoanalytical views about pleasure, but psychoanalytical ideas which have developed, I think, from Freud's ideas. Now, pleasure and analysis don't have a straightforward or uncomplicated relationship. Anybody who is or has been in analysis knows that the sense of pleasure isn't one which is constantly present in analytical sessions, neither for the analyst nor for the patient. And in a way, we know our patients come to us to be able to enjoy life, to be freed from their neurotic inhibitions. But again, it's very hard to allow people, sometimes it can be very hard, to have a sort of renewed access to pleasurable experiences. Sometimes people hold on to their neurotic misery. Of course, Freud, you may remember the famous quoted statement that Freud, in the last paragraph of the Studies in Hysteria, talks about transforming hysterical misery into common unhappiness, and gives a bit of a warning of what an analysis can achieve. Now, Freud starts, of course, with 1911, his the view of the pleasure principle, which he sees in a duality with the reality principle. But then later he has to modify his theory about pleasure because of the presence of masochism, which is obviously a difficult concept to explain, and his interest in the presence of the death instinct. You may remember he has an interesting idea about what he calls the Nirvana principle, which in his early theories, the Nirvana principle is associated with the pleasure principle. The pleasure principle aims at stability, at reducing tension, at reducing, if you want, unpleasure. When he later on, after Beyond the Pleasure Principle, he doesn't think of the Nirvana principle anymore as pleasure and pleasure. He actually connects it with the death instinct. In other words, aiming for a nirvana state of mind is more connected with attack on needs, on, you know, the reality of life. It's a sort of withdrawal into lack of life, in other words. Now, there are many developments from, as I said, Freud starts with a quantitative view about pleasure and, you know, reduction of tension. And, you know, he never abandons it, this view, even in when he has already talked about the death instinct. He talks about pleasure as he says that pleasure is the watchman, not just over psychic life. So he considers, again, I think what he means is probably not so much the search for pleasure, but avoiding unpleasure is actually one of the prime motives of psychic life. Views that come to mind in relation to Freud's original ideas. One is Byrne. Byrne is very inspired by the paper on the two principles of mental functioning, and he talks, it's again something that is very often repeated, and I'll quote from him. He says, "The choice that matters to the psychoanalyst is one which lies between procedures designed to evade frustration and those designed to modify it. This is the critical decision," he says. Now, when Byrne attributes a separate existence to the epistemophilic instinct, which he calls K, the dyadic juxtaposition between love and hate, eros and thanatos, life instinct, death instinct, becomes a triangulation between what Byrne calls L, H, and K. And so he shifts very much the emphasis from a sort of quantitative notion of pleasure and pleasure into one where the notion of K comes in and knowing about psychic reality. Just as a last sort of theoretical pointer, I just want to quote you from Hannah Seeger, who in 1993 writes about the clinical usefulness of the concept of death instinct. She says, "One could formulate the conflict between the life and death instinct in purely psychological terms. Birth confronts us with the experience of needs. In relation to that experience, there can be two reactions, and both, I think, are invariably present in all of us, though in varying proportions. One, to seek satisfaction for the needs, that is life-promoting and leads to object-seeking, love, and eventually object concern. The other is the drive to annihilate the need, to annihilate the perceiving experiencing self as well as anything that is perceived." So I think these are my sort of theoretical frame of reference. I do tend to think, you know, that it's the avoidance of psychic pain or discomfort rather than an active search for pleasure which I think becomes the watchman, to use Freud's phrase, of psychic life. Now, if we enter into, you know, the analytical situation and pleasure in the analytical situation, of course, the analytical situation has a strong pull towards regression, so many basic needs are evoked, but they're not satisfied, especially bodily, you know, satisfaction, pleasurable bodily satisfaction is banned from the consulting room. So pleasure in the analytical session takes up many forms. For instance, it can be pleasurable to repeat a certain sort of object configuration, but it can equally be pleasurable to be understood. It can be very pleasurable sometimes to have a sense of knowing oneself. You know, the pleasure about discovering things about oneself and knowing about them. One can be get tremendous pleasure in controlling, for instance, you know, the sort of holding on and controlling the analytical situation. Equally, it can be enormously pleasurable for patients to arrive and sort of pour out all the suffering and problems. So I think there are very many ways in which one can conceptualize pleasure. What I've done here, I've just chosen an ordinary day of analytical work, and I will give you three vignettes with patients just to think a bit with you about how pleasure appears in an analytical session. So I've chosen a Monday from now, it's a few months ago. My first patient, whom I shall call Mark, comes early in the morning. He begins the session with a dream about a fire which spreads from underneath and is difficult to extinguish. And there are also some knives hidden in a sofa. I think we both recognize themes from the previous analytical week: hidden passion and aggression related to sibling rivalry and Oedipal triangulation. My patient thinks of himself as mother's favorite, clever and successful, who fulfills mother expectation. He finds jealousy and rivalry difficult and relies on a thinly disguised sense of superiority. When Mark brings a dream, he's interested and expects me to be as well. He often tells me his dreams, and does so this morning, in a dreamy way, almost re-dreaming the dream in the session. He speaks in a soft, sleepy, sensuous voice and with a wandering, meandering narrative. The dreamy intensity, though, contrasts with the precision and accuracy with which he describes very minutely all the details in his dreams. Although I can feel sometimes irritated by his pedantic retrieval of all these details, I think he wants to give me an absolutely accurate description so that we can both inhabit his dream, be in the same place. There is an unquestionable pleasurable quality in the way he tells the dream and re-experiences in the session. He's often intrigued, surprised by some of his dreams. And he's also usually interested in what I have to say. So there is definitely some experience of pleasure in the session. But what is the nature of the pleasurable experience? I think Mark is interested in his mind, how it works. He's one of those patients who can actually enjoy his analysis. So he's delighted to have an unconscious mind. He's keen to know more about it. There is also a pleasure in offering me the contents of his mind. The analysis of a dream can generate an atmosphere of togetherness between us, something very desired by him, like the intimacy that he used to seek with his mother. And today, remember it's Monday, by bringing the dream at the very beginning of the session, I get involved with the dream, and that sort of closes the gap of the weekend separation. So you can see, I think, in this kind of interaction, a sort of tension between what I would call narcissistic pleasure, the pleasure in his mind, in his dream, is his produce, if you want. But he also needs a partner. He needs an analyst to interpret the dream. So pleasure becomes, this kind of particular kind of pleasure, becomes something which is shared by both of us. As I said, the exchange in the session reminds one of the toing and froing between a mother and an infant who are sort of listening to one another, can go back and forth, and, you know, develop, I think, some kind of ideas together. But I also think that Mark is trying to gratify an omnipotent fantasy of total togetherness with an object he has exclusive access to and which he can control. I want to mention a dream, a very interesting dream, which he brought at the beginning of his analysis, when he was engaged in some complicated sexual acrobatics which allowed him to pleasure himself in a masturbatory way while at the same time having intercourse with a woman who was lying beside him, pleasuring her as well. This, you know, isn't actually anatomically possible if you think about it, but it was actually possible for him in a dream that he could both, you know, give himself pleasure and give the woman pleasure at the same time. Now, I think this dream represents both his unconscious fantasy of the desired relationship with his object, where he is satisfying himself while satisfying the woman, probably tells you that he's reluctant just to have a relationship. He also wants to maintain the sort of narcissistic, which in the dream is the masturbatory part of the dream, while being involved with another person. I think it also probably conveys his very individual fantasy of what pleasure might consist for him. And one can ask, is this a revised edition of an early fantasy relationship with the breast, you know, where he's feeding, but also feeding himself rather than being fed by the breast? Another question, is the experience of pleasure, is it always associated with a fantasy of an object relation? Is the presence of a specific fantasy an object relation what gives pleasure its qualitative, to use Freud's term, and instinctively subjective characteristics? Comes to mind, you may have come across it, is a Moeneglelaufe, several years ago, put forward this very interesting idea of the central masturbatory fantasy, as if the central masturbatory fantasy gives you access to the complex world of internal object relationships. So this is Mark, involved in sort of telling me the dream and sort of getting some pleasure out of it. My second patient, whom I shall call Paul, has a very different experience of analysis. While Mark is curious, intensely introspective, Paul's anxiety cripples his curiosity and his ability to engage and enjoy the analysis. I think he feels intensely scrutinized by what he perceives as my intrusive gaze, frightened and ashamed of what I would see. He appears genial, polite, cooperative, but lacks emotional depth. A veneer of easygoing jolliness hides his great difficulty in expressing deep emotions. He uses obsessional and schizoid defenses and can be very controlling. He was a slow developer, which probably is a bit of a euphemism, in a loving and supportive family of high achievers. An all-pervasive inhibition restricts and undermines him. The analysis has progressively challenged his control and exposed his high anxiety, reviving his past sense of being slow and an underachiever compared to his more successful siblings. In one of his dreams, he portrayed himself like a dinosaur in a cage, a solitary remnant of a bygone age. There are sessions where he talks and talks in an automatic, mechanical way, especially if he has a dream. But there are many more sessions in which he becomes stuck, tired, these are his words, and barely talks. In these sessions, he conveys his difficulty in describing what he's feeling. He rarely talks in the first person and uses things like a sense of stuckness, a sense of depletion, something a bit like, which gives you a sense of the enormous difficulty that he has to articulate his own feelings. But what one understands or senses is how incredibly difficult it is to be in contact with another person. So he presents, I think, with some desperation, but also an aggressive passivity in this sort of silent nirvana-like state of withdrawal. Now, I've often thought of him, as I associate him to an old song, which I don't know if how many of you may remember, which is, I think it's an old Roberta Flack number called Killing Me Softly. Yes. So that's the song, the words are like strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly. I think his softness harbors murderous rage. But I also think I need to be soft with him, like his parents, I think, were. I think Paul, and this is the point about pleasure and not having access to pleasure, is inhabited by an object who is terrified of emotional life and softly kills any sign of anxiety, pain and aggression, but in this process also kills liveliness and pleasure. His superego persuades him that engaging with the intensity of life is fraught with dangers and is better off withdrawing from life. Pleasure and pain in this man clearly differentiated, I think they coalesce into what I see as an amorphous amalgam of equanimity, which covers up his anxiety. Just to give you a sense of this amalgam, or you could even call it a fusion of instinct, he recently brought a dream of a group of terrorists dressed up as marshmallows. So you have the, you know, the enormously frightening, aggressive, you know, quality of the terrorist, but is dressed up as marshmallow with that sort of sweet, gooey, white and pink, aren't they, marshmallows? And that's exactly what he does. But I think it's the encasing of the terrorist in the marshmallow. The marshmallows encases the terrorist, and that's what kills life. Life is killed softly. Pleasure is killed softly. Aggression is killed softly. And that, of course, you know, has got many, many complications. So that's my second case. How am I doing? Yes, I think I'm doing all right. My third patient, she's a woman, Emma, I call her. She sought treatment because she could not disentangle herself from an affair with an older and powerful man. Married with one little boy, she felt terribly guilty about betraying her husband, but found it impossible to give her lover up. Although she knew that neither she nor he would ever want to leave their respective spouses. Of this relationship, she says, this relationship is possible because it is impossible. In the session this morning, she complains, as she often does, about how cruel and impossible her lover is. Both Emma and her lover spend much time complaining that the love they proffer for one another is not true. She doubts her lover's love in an almost cynical way, and he says, from what I hear, the same about her protestations of love. So this morning, it's Monday, she tells me he completely interrupted contact with her at the weekend after a few days of non-stop texts where he was pledging his undying love. He was with his family. When she complained about this, he was angry and aggressive. She was sick. He didn't pay any attention to her sort of plight. Now, I've heard about this complaint so many times. Now, I could take this up in the transference, as analysts do, and treat, you know, the situation. She's talking about me at the weekend, and I ignore her, etc. It doesn't feel that that's quite where she's at. I think that the importance of the communication is that her I am asked to agree with her that the lover perpetrates some emotional abuse towards her, and I should acknowledge her suffering and rescue her from it. But I don't think she wants to be rescued. Emma seems to be, in a sense, wanting to stay in the state of affair. I feel quite helpless with this repetitive material. I'm tempted to, you know, abandon the analytical position in favor of a moralistic, a didactic one. So it's almost as if the relationship, the analytical relationship, has become possible because it is impossible. There isn't a sort of real possibility of an intercourse between us, but just a sort of me acknowledging that this is the reality. Now, there are shades of an early Oedipal history behind the sense that the experience of being truly loved or the capacity to love others painfully elude her. With her affair, Emma seems to be expressing her rivalrous Oedipal feelings with her mother and me in the transference. She has the big, powerful man, she triumphs over mother and gets a powerful father. But I think she's also enacting a deeply disappointing relationship with her elusive mother. Up to this day, Emma feels her mother is never fully emotionally available to her. She seems to be seeking out a powerful father penis as an alternative, I think, to the non-available mother. But in fact, I think she mourns the impossible closeness with her inaccessible maternal object. There was an episode which I thought was incredibly significant. Her lover texted her, saying to her, I can't forget how beautiful you are. He was praising her beauty. Now, she was lunching with her husband and her little boy. The little boy picks the phone up and reads the message and reads it out loud. And, you know, the husband says, who is that for? And my patient, in a sort of unconscious, I thought, completely unconscious self-defense to protect herself from the lie, says, it's from my mother. Which I thought was so interesting that, you know, it was, of course, a lover. But it's almost as if in that moment she, unconsciously, I think, she went back. She wants a mother who tells her she's beautiful. And, you know, of course, it was also meant to diffuse, you know, that. But I thought it was so interesting that, you know, it's from my mother. And the husband, strangely enough, believed it. So back to Emma's anguish complaints about being trapped in emotional abuse. Is there pleasure in this session? Well, ostensibly she suffers a great deal. She does not get much pleasure from the contact with her lover, sexually or otherwise. Guilt sours the relationship with her husband and child. And as I said, we can both suffer in this session. Yet, there is some gratification from remaining in this position. The main pleasure in the relationship with art is derived from the shared interest in paintings or the artists they deal with. Art is a major art dealer, the lover, and my patient owns a small struggling gallery. I think it's a sort of intermediate, you could say sublimated space, a neutral space, which is not generated by their own creativity. Other people create the paintings. I think in the session, she paints a distinct, recognizable, repeated picture of herself and her objects. I've often thought of this sort of repetitive picture in the session. You know Andy Warhol's multiple paintings, you know, especially the ones Marilyn Monroe, who is, of course, a tragic figure who couldn't find love, you know, and killed herself because she couldn't find love. I think, you know, there's something about it. Now, Emma is frightened of losing the relationship with the lover, frightened of the emptiness and the helplessness that it would generate. She says that without him, she would feel without the protection that this powerful man who works in a professional field gives her. Her masochistic suffering has indeed a protective function and makes her powerful, and it's very difficult for her to give it up. It also protects her from a fuller engagement with me and the analysis. This is a very complex situation, Emma's situation, with many implications. Now, repetition and masochistic pleasure are at the forefront in this session. Repetition and the pleasure associated with it plays, of course, an important part in development when it's used at the service of mastery and a protection from anxiety and loss. For instance, a request that a story is always read in exactly the same way to a little child is a good example of how pleasurable and useful repetition can be for a child. But there is a different kind of pleasure derived from the compulsive repetition of a certain object configuration or the enactment of a certain fantasy which cannot be worked through. I think it's interesting to think how these two kinds of experience can interact during development, and when does one form of repetition crystallize into the other. With Emma, one could say that an early difficulty of internalizing a good object pushes her to an attachment, to a masochistic one. So I'm going to stop here.
Okay, well, we're going to go straight on to the next talk and then have time for discussion for both papers at the end, bearing in mind a 5-minute, the clock is fast. So Luis Rodriguez de la Sierra has worked many years at the Anna Freud Center, so it's a sort of homecoming for him, and also in the NHS. He's spoken at Freud Museum conferences before, and he now works at the London Clinic of Psychoanalysis and in private practice. He's published many papers on child analysis and drug addiction, and is the editor of Child Analysis Today, and co-author with Joan Schachter, who's also a psychoanalyst at the BPAS, of The Late Teenage Years. He has an abiding interest in classical ballet, and since my sister was a ballet dancer, we've had conversations about that, which he's discussed at a number of events with leading dancers, but he can't give tickets to the Eugene Onyegin, which is on at the moment. But if anybody wanted. So I'll hand it over to Luis.
All right. Yes, I'm not going to dance today, but it's a coming back home, as I spent many years here, and this is a place where I did my child analytic training. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Right. Now the subject that occupies us today is a vast one, and we could talk about it from a psychoanalytic point of view, cultural, literary, religious. It's a non-stop one. But I'm going to stick to the analytic point. And I would like to say that in order to talk about the role of pleasure, about the role of love, in psychic development, we need to think about early infantile development first, and then continuing the developmental model to think what pleasure means to the other developmental stages. The model that I am using is only one of the three which we are lucky to have in this country. So I'm going to talk from another Freudian perspective. But as you know, we have also the contributions of Mrs. Klein and Winnicott, and with all the fights being left behind, I think that nowadays we try to help each other to identify the sounds we cannot hear and cannot repeat, so that we can use them. I'd like to begin by quoting two Spanish mystics, St. John of the Cross, San Juan de la Cruz, to whom there was only one love that we could all and should aspire to, and that was the love of God. That was, according to him, the only one which was valid. However, his correspondence with the other great Spanish mystic, Santa Teresa de Ávila, is considered by many so erotic that, according to popular belief, it gave origin to what is supposed to have been the famous reply when he requested a meeting. She said to him, "Entre santa y santo, pared de calicanto," which means, "Between a male saint and a female saint, only a very thick iron wall will do." But the famous transverberation episode from Teresa's autobiography, which depicts a cherubim penetrating the nun's heart with a blazing spear, gives an insight into her awareness of the forbidden pleasures of the flesh and of the close link between pleasure and pain. Both Sigmund Freud and Anna Freud emphasized the importance in human functioning of the pleasure principle. The natural tendency to seek pleasure through gratification and satisfaction of needs, wishes, and impulses, and to avoid unpleasure, such as the frustration, anxiety, and pain. Conflicts arise the moment seeking pleasure and avoiding pain ceases to be a simple, unidimensional matter. For instance, when two pleasurable aims conflict, the child, for instance, realizes he cannot satisfy his greed and get his mother's approval at the same time, or he cannot vent his rage on someone who has frustrated him because he also wants and needs that person unharmed. Or even when unpleasurable happenings he would prefer to avoid, such as injections, hair washing, toothbrushing, are presented by someone whom the child wishes to please, or when pain unexpectedly results from something the child had foreseen as pleasurable, for instance, getting bruised in a fall while climbing over furniture or later on onto trees, getting burned by something which is beautiful and attractive, such as fire, etc. In all situations, the child has to come to terms slowly with reality and works at finding compromise solutions between his various wishes and needs. This is, by the way, the work of the ego. The child is initially dominated by the pleasure principle and experiences his first conflict not within himself, but with the people who oppose his wishes or who fail to provide the gratification he seeks. It is only through learning within important relationships that the child develops conflicting wishes within himself, wishes to please and preserve the object, conflict with various other wishes for pleasure and gratification. It is therefore not always appropriate to make interpretations in terms of internal conflicts to small children who have not yet developed that far, or to children who have lacked the close relationships within which such conflicts develop, or whose parents have provided inadequate models for development. Because they are not children who are suffering from neurotic or psychotic symptoms, but from developmental deficits. Now, the newborn is a law unto himself, ruled by his built-in pleasure principle, striving to reduce unpleasant tension. However, apart from erotic gratifications, he cannot achieve the satisfaction he seeks without his mother's help. Throughout life, the pleasure principle continues to rule unconscious processes, such as fantasy and dreaming, and is also involved in neurotic and psychotic symptom formation. Now, it is impossible to talk about pleasure without mentioning today the concept of fusion. Freud had initially thought of sadism as an aggressive component of the libido, and masochism as a secondary phenomenon resulting from the turning round on the self of sadism. In Beyond the Pleasure Principle, he says, but how can the sadistic instinct, whose aim it is to injure the object, be derived from Eros, the preserver of life? Is it not plausible to suppose that this sadism is in fact a death instinct, which under the influence of the narcissistic libido has been forced away from the ego and has consequently only emerged in relation to the object? The forces of sexuality and aggression and the feeling states that love and hate compound retain their power and play a major part in development from the cradle not only to the couch, but to the grave. The story of civilization, whether personal or collective, is in large measure the story of the taming of these powerful drives. Now, the very young child has only the crudest of defensive measures at his disposal. Two are universal and call for special attention: projection and displacement. Since hostility to the primary object is so dangerous, the nearest animate or inanimate object can quickly come under attack. Toys really suffer maltreatment and have the advantage of not returning the noisy or physical insults hurled upon them. And if rather later someone who by his very presence has done the child an enduring injury is close to hand, a convenient target may be available to assuage distress through assault: a brother, a sister, especially a younger and weaker one. If displacement and projection combine, the hostility to the competitor is both further intensified and returned in equal measure, and that makes hatred a good deal easier to justify. He hates me, and that is why I hate him. In the established perversion, sadism is the conscious infliction of pain on others for the purpose of sexual gratification, masochism being the passive counterpart. But a restriction of the meaning of both, namely sadism and masochism, to the manifest perversions would leave a great deal of human behavior unaccounted for. While elements of sadism and masochism enter into sexual relations that stop well short of perversion, unconscious sadism and masochism play a major part in normal human interchange. Now, whether overt or covert, conscious or unconscious, both sadism and masochism involved a kind of joint action by the sexual and destructive drives, a coordinated search for common gratification. It is as if, under certain circumstances, love no longer modifies or counteracts hate, but joins forces with it in the interest of unified pleasure. Without a sexual component, aggression is just aggression, not sadism. If the aim of aggression is the destruction of the object, the aim of sadism, paradoxically, is to preserve it. I would like to give you, if I can, two vignettes and one observation, which is not even mine, but which I heard from a colleague and I thought would illustrate the point. A 3-year-old little girl is waiting with her parents for a delayed flight in a crowded and small waiting room. She reacts with intense crying when her mother suddenly leaves to go to the loo. Inconsolable, she continues crying and becomes even more upset when her father, embarrassed by his daughter's crying, tries to tell her to stop, insisting she is misbehaving, and that is not the place to become upset in that way because she is annoying other people. That obviously doesn't work. A woman who is also present in the room and witnesses the scene and who is obviously worried about the little girl's suffering approaches her and offers her a necklace to play with and begins to play with the little girl. Gradually but increasingly, the little girl begins to calm down, starts playing with the lady and her necklace, and finally stops crying. This is a case where we can observe how the pleasure of playing helped the little girl to bear her distress. It is of course clear that the maternal input provided by the lady also contributed to the diminution of the little girl's distress. But needless to say, it reminded me of the pleasure some children experience while playing, as well as reminding me of those children unable to play and therefore incapable of defending against states of unpleasure. I would imagine this is what made Winnicott say at some stage that the aim in analysis with a child who cannot play is to enable the child to play. This is why he defended the role of the analyst as being one of engaging in the playing with the child. My second example it goes back to nearly 15 years ago. I called him Juan. He's a latency boy in 5 times a week analysis, and about whom I have written several times. He arrived one day to my consulting room. It was a new consulting room. It must be about 15 years ago. I used to see the children either here or at the clinic, at the institute, when we were in New Cavendish Street. But we moved, and suddenly many of us were left without a consulting room. So I had to take the children to the adult consulting room. The child comes and immediately notices something that I thought I had hidden very well. And he says, "What is that?" And I say, "A computer." The child is delighted and invites me to play. That computer had been given to me just the day before I didn't have the faintest idea of what to do with it. So I had to confess to him and be humiliated by him in saying that I didn't know what to do with it. And he said he thought I was taking the mickey out of him. He thought I was pretending not to know. But the moment of my revenge arrived shortly afterwards. He looked right and he saw something and he said, "What is that?" And I announced now triumphantly, "A typewriter." My typewriter is an old one of those that you used to pull. You have to pull the keys out. So he tried. He said, "What is it for?" I said, "It's like a computer to write." He tried to use it, and he came to the conclusion it was an infernal machine he would never master. So we came to an agreement. He said we would play a game. He would accept my lie that I didn't know what to do with the computer, and we would play at teaching each other. He was going to teach me to use the computer, and I was going to teach him to use the typewriter. So I agreed to use what is really a developmental help technique. I mean, something that used to be done, and I would imagine continues to be done in this place. Now, the pleasure that he experienced in learning and teaching me was enormous. Purely from a developmental point of view, I would like to suggest that he displays the pleasure that normally a latency child would feel or experience in learning something new, at the same time that in the transference he had the opportunity to feel closer to a father who in reality expressed interest in him only to tell him off every time he failed in learning new tasks. An extremely intelligent boy who underfunctioned because of anxiety, which increased even more in the presence of a father whom he experienced as very castrating. So through our mutual teaching each other, he experienced the pleasure of a different relationship with a new developmental object as well as a transference one. Children often show signs of pleasure at different stages of their development through the mastering of certain developmental milestones, such as learning to walk, the acquisition of language, playing, etc. One of the pleasures from infancy that I have observed often repeated in the analysis not only of children, but also adolescents and adults, is associated to the acquisition of the new language. In analysis, the language of the unconscious, which is provided by our patients to us and that we reshape and give it back to them. My second or my third example, I have just the time, is a patient whom I saw about 5 years ago, a 30-year-old professional man who approached me asking for help. He had problems with drugs and alcohol since he was a teenager, an only child who, like many young patients in his situation, used drugs in a way when he tried to deal with psychic pain, the one that he had experienced since his parents divorced when he was 5. And his father went to live abroad with a new woman and her children. Like many alcoholics, he sought pleasure, in quotation marks, in his adolescence by turning to alcohol and to substances he could control and which would not abandon him, oblivious to the negative implications of this new object relation that replaced relations with human beings. He turns to substances that would mitigate not only the loss of his object, but also of his childhood, added to the anxiety provoked by the arrival of an unknown and threatening new developmental phase. I'd agreed to see him 3 times in order to make a full assessment, and concluded by telling him that, in my opinion, he needed full analysis 5 times a week. He accepted at once, which is very rare in alcoholics and drug addicts, but he was very disappointed when I told him I couldn't do it because I didn't have any vacancy. And I said I wouldn't have a vacancy at least for 3 years. Immediately said he would wait. I was surprised, but didn't think he would do it, as addicts are rarely able to tolerate waiting. And I mean, they do not wait for the satisfaction or gratification of their needs and desires. I suggested, though, that he contact AA, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, in the meantime, not being sure either that he would do so. I forgot about him completely, but about 1.5 years ago, I found myself one day wondering about him. I could not remember his name, but I remembered everything about our encounter. You can imagine my surprise when I arrived to my consulting room and I had a message on my answering machine from this patient, wondering whether I remembered him and saying that 3 years had elapsed exactly that day and that he was coming back to find out whether I had a vacancy. But now he said he would accept that even if I didn't have one, he would go to somebody else whom I would know, whose name I would give to him. I didn't have a vacancy. It meant seeing him early in the morning, which I hate. I am not a morning person. But I thought it was my obligation. I thought I have to do it. There is a special communication here, and it is so rare that these patients come to you spontaneously. They come usually because of a legal problem or somebody in the family is forcing them. So I started seeing this patient, who has turned out to be an extremely rewarding analytic patient. The pleasure we both felt, because I think it is both, in the transference and counter-transference was, I thought, related to a repetition in the analysis, a repetition, not an enactment, of the pain or pleasure experienced by the 5-year-old little boy in being forced to separate from his father and losing his father, and the happiness and safety he had previously experienced by having his parents with him, thus surviving to his Oedipal hostile feelings. The pleasure we both experienced was, I thought, related to the re-encounter and recovery of the lost object. I meant the boy recovering his father and the father, me, in the transference, recovering his son. And I'll stop here.
Okay, so plenty of time for questions.
Thank you. Why was it not a reenactment, and what would make it different if it was?
An enactment.
And what would be different if it was?
Enactment is a funny word because it can be thought and formulated in different ways. Nowadays, it has become a four-letter word. An enactment is usually used to refer to something that the analyst does in collusion unconsciously with the patient. It's a kind of unconscious complicity where the analyst is kind of seduced into repeating something. A repetition in the analysis, or something which one does at times in developmental health, is something that the analyst is fully conscious is going on, is happening. So that is the main difference.
Does it matter whether the person who's being analyzed is conscious of it, and whether they share pleasure to the same extent, or indeed whether the person who's being analyzed is deriving any pleasure from it?
Or the person who is analyzed.
Being analyzed. You said you both share the pleasure.
Yes.
How do we know that he shares the pleasure, and how do we know he's conscious of what's going on between the two of you?
He wasn't completely conscious of what was going on. I mean, he is. By now, because of my interpretation, because of my drawing his attention to it, does it matter whether the patient is aware of an enactment in the negative sense or not? I think it does, in the sense that if the analyst is simply colluding with the patient, I'm not quite sure the patient is deriving anything positive from it. That is my thing. It may be that, you see, an enactment is an interesting question, because an enactment is something that the analyst might, it's a sin that the analyst may commit, if I am allowed to use this Catholic language. But if the analyst realizes this afterwards and recovers his analytic stance, that's okay. The problem is only if one goes on doing it without being aware that one is doing it. See?
I mean,
yes?
Can I just add something? I think for me the difference would be not so much in trying to tightly differentiate enactment from repetition, because an enactment always contains, tends to, at least how I think, a repetition of a past history. The quality for me will differentiate something that can be used for understanding, something that ejects understanding, is, I suppose, ultimately, what is the enactment, the way in which something gets communicated, or is it a way of getting rid of something? And I thought with Luis's case, it was clearly, he said, it was, what was reenacted was the experience of the loss.
Yes.
Loss of the object, and then and what was interesting was, of course, that Luis had retrieved himself the lost patient. I thought it was a very, communicative.
But if I may, if you allow me, the question is broader and applies to other encounters as well, not only psychoanalytics. Is pleasure only meant to be labeled as such if shared by both who are in the game, or if only perceived as one of the parties as being a pleasurable encounter, activity, you name it, you can then call it pleasure?
That's a fundamental question.
Yes.
The difference between narcissistic pleasure, say people who go and pump iron in the gym, for instance, they're running. What sort of pleasure is it? You see, I slightly differ from Luis when he says the infant is dominated, is a pleasure seeker, the pleasure principle. I slightly differ. I think, and that possibly connects to your question, the infant is just as much object seeking as he is pleasure seeking. So for me, in some ways, and probably there's a slight theoretical difference, Freud's theory of primary narcissism versus, Melanie Klein idea of object relationship, that from the very beginning. I think they both exist, don't you? A pleasure which is, one's, but even the pleasure on one's own, for me, always contains a fantasy of an object relationship. So I don't think pleasure exists in a solipsistic way. Even the most masturbatory, even playing with a computer, for 10 hours a day, I always think that there's a fantasy of an object relation. So you're always with the this is how I see it, connected with a fantasy object.
Isn't Lewis saying also how the pleasure is finding the object? I mean, that seemed to be,
The object, yes, that the pleasure.
Yeah, rather than
finding it and In keeping it.
Yeah. But the other fundamental thing from the first question is how can you know another person's pleasure? I mean, how can we be aware of another person's pleasure, which is a kind of philosophical question, I suppose.
But a very interesting one.
I hope you won't find me presumptuous. I thought that the secret to the last bit of your story was that you're saying yes and going out of your way gave you a fund of transference capital that would go a long, long way. I'll tell you an analogy. It may not be a very good one, but it came to mind. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to publish Nina Coulthard's papers, and she had turned down a lot of publishers. And one day I went up to her and asked her, and she said, ask me in 3 years. 3 years to the day I rang her, and she said yes.
Can I say one thing just in response to Giliola? You know, one of the things that I like in doing, in working with colleagues who belong to another theoretical school, is because in 1948, a meeting that was going to take place between Anna Freud and Melanie Klein was interrupted, because somebody said it is not a good idea to have it outside of the society. I think it is a shame, because so many things could have been avoided and we could have learned much more of each other. One question remains in my mind, although, as I said before, the developmental model I use is the Anna Freudian one, according to which these things depend on the state of maturity of the ego. Anna Freud, in her developmental profile, presents us with something which is slightly confusing. She says there are three types of conflicts. The initial conflicts are external ones. The baby is in conflict with the external world. Later, the trademark of the neurosis is the internalized conflicts. But in between that, she talks about something that, and this is where the confusion comes and where I always hope that the Kleinians might help me to understand what Miss Freud may have meant. She spoke about internal conflicts, something that the baby comes to the world with. In that sense, there's a meeting point with Klein, in the idea that the child comes to the world with something. But then she adds that these so-called conflicts only become conflictive later as the ego matures. And that is the thing. But the idea that there is something from the beginning, and I tell you what they are, is the opposition between masculinity and femininity, passivity and activity, love and hatred. So I always hope that that aborted conversation can still take place.
I think Klein sees the infant, the mother, they're all a bit metaphors as well, aren't they?
Yes.
You don't have to take it too literally. I think the infant for Klein is you know, from the very beginning, conflict is there, you know, that there's a frustration of, you know, the bliss of being at the breast and then being put down. So, and the conflict, if you want, that generates. So internal conflict, I think, is seen as, you know, as part of life, as Hannah, you know, the bit I quoted from Hannah Sieber, you know, and that's how she, you know, life and death instinct, either you turn to your object or you withdraw narcissistically from your object. It's a different view of early conflict. So the conflict for Sieber would be between turning to your object or annihilating the need. That would be the sort of which I think is different.
No.
Apparently there's a Twitter feed or something. I don't really do those things, but there's a Twitter feed to do with people giving names for different sexual positions appropriate to Britain. So we sent in the depressive position.
The depressive position.
I was actually thinking of Winnicott's idea that you've got to be a bit depressed to be in Britain. Anyway. But anyway, it's kind of...
Well, but the depressive position, what do you see about the depressive position? The depressive position is good if it's means
good,
concern for the other.
Absolutely.
You know? So you're making love, you know, so the concern about the pleasure of the other. So sounds bad, but depends very much what you mean, actually.
I expect this is a very naive question, but what is, to the speakers, or both speakers, what is the, how do you differentiate between pleasure and love? I don't understand the distinction.
Ladies always first.
He's avoiding the attention of being the first, but he pretends to be concerned for love. But truly, really and truly avoiding...
Softly aggressive.
Softly aggressive. Oh, I think they're different, aren't they? Mm. Now, how can we try to think about it? I mean, what comes to mind, there's a kind of, the first thing that comes to mind is not so much the intensity, but I would say something to do with the continuity and the sustainability, I would say, that being in love, first of all, can be very important. You know, mm-hmm. Especially unrequited love is one of the worst things you can think of. So, I don't know, I tend to think about it. One more of a sensual, sensory, much more, you know, physical perhaps. Mm-hmm. And the other one is, I know I think I'm very banal, but you know, but love is about a much more complex sort of set of feelings, I think. And you can love... You know, you can love a painting, for instance, and feeling pleasure in looking at it. But in terms of relationships and human beings, I think the two are quite different. One, I think of it as much more, you know, sort of immediate, perhaps. Gratification comes to mind, you know, as another notion connected with pleasure. I think love... No, it seems to me that love implies decay of being. You know, are you familiar with the LH and K? All right. There's a different dimension to it, which is knowing about something. That's just Louis.
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's a difficult question because although love and pleasure coincide sometimes, they do not always do, and they can be very different. To me, love contains, and to put it again in a banal everyday language, love contains the element of a certain altruism or sacrifice that pleasure does not necessarily is not necessarily accompanied by. Pleasure is for the gratification of things in the subject which cannot necessarily contain a concern for the object. I think a concern for the object is very often the companion of love. Not necessarily always a companion of pleasure.
You see it in babies, I'm sorry again to be banal, you know, you see when you breastfeed a baby, or when you see a baby being breastfed, that there is a difference between those very first early feeds and the later one when the infant lifts up his or her eyes, looks at the mother, smiles, pauses. You can tell that some of it is I suppose, pleasurable, you know, like hungry baby at the breast and sucks, you know, you can see the gratification. But there is a time, which is not exactly when they're tiny, tiny, mm-hmm. when the relationship begins, when they start looking up at you. And I think that's, for me, very much like Chris says, that's when there's a person there, isn't there? And perhaps you could say pleasure has got a more narcissistic quality to it.
Indeed.
And love is object-centered. And given that my idea is that babies are sort of object-related from mm-hmm. the very beginning, you know, I think the two develop very much together. And, of course, I do think, you know, that there's something about the way in which your love and the pleasure in being loved, you know, if you have inside a figure who got tremendous pleasure out of loving you, as an infant, I think that's tremendously important in terms of establishing a capacity to love later on. And then I think the two might go together.
I think there was an indication in both your papers about something about different kinds of pleasure coming from different parts of what Freud would call the mental apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about pleasure connected to a narcissistic pleasure, you know, that might be, you know, in relation to the ego or, you know, or pleasure about being loved from, could you say perhaps a bit more about that sense of the differentiation of pleasure and how you see that?
You see, once again, it is difficult in relation to narcissism. Let me just reassociate, and I hope you will help me to get to the point. To me, love is closer to the idea of maternal love, what a mother experiences for her baby, something which is not always easily experienced by fathers, by men. In saying that, I think immediately of a Spanish psychiatrist, Gregorio Marañón, now dead, who used to say that we men only understand and tune in with the idea of loving our children when we become grandfathers. What he's saying, although he doesn't elucidate it well, is that the concept of love in his mind for the man is so connected to the idea of pleasure, libidinal pleasure. Now you could say, well, the mother also experiences some kind of pleasure of that kind. Maybe, but I think it is different. I don't know how I could define it, but I think it's a different kind of love, something which is difficult for men to understand, to experience, to convey. I don't know.
It's an association I have following what you just said is actually Freud's unfortunate, I think, differentiation about how women love and how men love. And if you remember, he tended to overvalue, actually, men's capacity, that men love altruistically and women love more narcissistically. That was just one, I think very much determined by the kind of sort of time in which he lived. And Louis sort of reverses it.
Indeed, I mean, yes.
I think that's very interesting.
What I'm saying is the opposite.
Absolutely the opposite. And yet Freud, I'm sure, in a way which we wouldn't find, I could never quite relate to that, thought that women, modality women, love is a more narcissistic one, whereas men are more object-centered, focused on the other.
Perhaps it is not quite a question of love, but we can perhaps enjoy a tea break now and give some thanks to the...